Okay, so I was trying to figure out when two Higgs double models were invented, but it's probably T.D. Lee in the early 70s. So we're already past the 30th anniversary. You might wonder what more can you say? And we were surprised to find that there's still a lot of things we don't understand about this very simple model. So I hope to tell you a few things about this. And the motivation, well, we all know that the minimal supersymmetric standard model employs a two Higgs doublet model, and that's perhaps the best motivated two Higgs doublet model. But I'm going to really focus on something that goes a little bit beyond, perhaps, although I'll make some comments emphasizing that, in fact, the most general two Higgs doublet model does apply, in some sense, to the MSSM as well. I'll then focus on Higgs-fermion interactions and explicit CP violation. Those are really the two main topics. So you know that the two Higgs doublet model that appears in the minimal supersymmetric standard model is a very particular two Higgs doublet model, where the couplings of the Higgses to themselves are expressed in terms of gauge couplings, and in fact, you don't have the most general Higgs potential, but one that's constrained by supersymmetry. However, the minute you take into account that the model is not exactly supersymmetric, there are radiative corrections which can, in some cases, be large. And so, effectively, in the Lohengy approximation, you have actually a completely general two Higgs doublet model. And so, when you go out to the LHC and the linear collider and try to verify that the Higgs bosons you're discovering match some theoretical underpinning, you're going to want to try to measure the general parameters of that model and match on to whatever theory that you think is relevant. So the general two Higgs doublet model consists of two identical hypercharge 1 scalar doublets, which I'll call phi 1 and phi 2. And because they are identical, I'm always free to redefine the two doublets by taking two different linear combinations. And this is a familiar story. Which linear combinations you choose to start off with is a question of choice of basis in the Higgs flavor space, where this Higgs flavor space is a complex two-dimensional space. Now, given that fact, one immediate conclusion, perhaps surprisingly, is that this ubiquitous parameter tan beta that you see all over the place is actually not a very meaningful parameter, because it presupposes that you have made a choice of basis. And
Excuse me.
Yes.
Is it not that the choice of basis is fixed as soon as you start putting in the couplings to fermions?
Depends. It depends.
Higgs doublet 2, you would use one for the uptype,
If you choose that particular pattern of couplings, that's true. Now, you might say that, well, the MSSM makes that particular choice. In fact, it's required to by supersymmetry. On the other hand, the minute supersymmetry is broken, you generate the other terms. If by radiative, they can be large in certain domains of parameter space, and then you begin to lose this connection.
But if you want to suppress naturally, pretty much changing neutral patterns, then you
Yeah.
have a few choices.
Yes, we'll come to that. Be patient. Okay, so the underlying theme of this talk is that I want to formulate a completely basis-independent approach to the two Higgs doublet model, and then express all physical parameters in a way that don't depend on what I call phi 1 and what I call phi 2. So here's my generic two Higgs doublet potential with three mass parameters and seven coupling parameters, of which, in fact, some of them may be complex. M1, 2 squared, lambda 5, lambda 6, and lambda 7 could be in principle complex. The VEVs are defined as usual, and the Higgs flavor space is labeled by 1 and 2, and I can think about doing arbitrary U2 transformations within that flavor space, and that would be a rotation of this form here. And so I'm going to introduce a notation. It's very convenient to distinguish two types of labels, one A like that, and another one here you can barely see, B bar, there's a bar on that. And this is just to keep track of how the transformations work. So I can rewrite this in the following way and introduce a tensor in this two-dimensional flavor space Y and another tensor Z. These tensors have hermeticity properties. I've written them down here. And the nice thing about setting up the notation and distinguishing between barred and unbarred indices is that these tensors now transform covariantly under the U2 transformations, and I've written out examples. Here's the transformation law for Y. Here's the transformation law for Z. So if I were to change my basis by making this rotation, we can compute how the masses, parameters, and the couplings change.
How is phi 1 adjoint phi 2 times phi 1 adjoint phi 1 that allowed?
Phi 1 adjoint phi 2, that's somewhere in here. Phi 1 adjoint phi 2 times phi 1 adjoint phi 1. The minimum condition you can write using these tensors, oh my God, PDF is really screwed up on, I didn't even notice this. All right, I obviously in the postscript there was a, that's a curious, bug, I guess, in Adobe Acrobat 6.0. Mm. Okay, I apologize for that. Hopefully there won't be too many of those. Okay, so I'm going to always assume that the minimum of the potential conserves electromagnetism, and so here's the most general VEV, where this VEV is a two-dimensional vector in the flavor space, and at the moment I'll have arbitrary complex numbers here. Now, in addition to this VEV V here, I can also define a related vector W, which will be useful, which is related to V with an epsilon symbol, and if I throw in a dependence on these two phases in a clever enough way, I will discover that this W also transforms under the U2 transformation in a simple way. Now, actually, the full U2 transformation is not needed because, as you know, sitting inside that U2 transformation is U1 hypercharge. And U1 hypercharge doesn't have any effect on the mass parameters or the couplings of the model. However, it can be used to change the phases of the vacuum expectation value, and so I'll often use that freedom to get rid of that phase up there. And if I do that, then I'll restrict my use to a slightly smaller set of U2 transformations, like so. That's a small point. Don't worry about that. Now, having set this all up, the goal is to construct invariants. That's things that are invariant under the change in basis. And we're all very familiar of how to take covariantly transforming tensors and combine them together and make invariants. Just have to suck up all the indices. Here's a simple example. Take the coupling tensor, Z, A, B, C, D, and throw in a bunch of Vs until you've sucked up all the indices. Here's an example, Z1. And now plug in what the z's are. They're lambda 1 through lambda 7, depending on what labels you have there. Write it all out, and this is what you get. And what this means is that this particular linear combination of couplings does not change when I make a U2 transformation. Now, there's a very special basis, which has been called the Higgs basis sometimes in the literature, where you put all the VEV in, say, the first guy. So phi A. And so phi A would be V over root 2, phi B would be 0. And in that basis, V hat, this two-dimensional vector, is very simple. It's just 1, 0. And W hat is 0, 1. And so what you see is that Z1 really corresponds to the coefficient of the quartic term in the potential that just depends on the field with the VEV. Okay, now you can continue the process. And here's a complete list of invariants where I've absorbed all the free indices by throwing in factors of the VEV, V, or the related W. And naturally, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the number of possibilities and the number of couplings in mass terms. And you can then just stick in the values of those tensors and work it out. I had already worked out for you what Z1 is, and here's a complete list of all those invariants. And again, I emphasize is the utility of all these things is all these objects are independent of what basis I started with.
Are they real or complex?
Well, Z5, Z6, and Z7 are complex, and Y3 is complex. You see the I's here. There's an I there, an I there. So the same number of complex things. Now, in fact, the Higgs basis, which I talked about, I can actually make a transformation from the generic basis to the Higgs basis, because all I have to do is find the U2 matrix that puts all the VEV in the first Higgs. And when I do that and work out the corresponding Higgs potential in the Higgs basis, I find that these invariants are precisely the coefficients of the Higgs potential in that basis. And here are the minimum conditions. So these invariants have a very nice interpretation. These invariants actually correspond to the value of the Higgs potential parameters in this special basis. There's a comment about the decoupling limit. I'll just say a word about that in a minute. Now, so far, the model I've exhibited to you in principle exhibits CP violations. So for the first part of the talk, I want to specialize to the case where there are no complex things at all. And I'll just talk about the CP conserving model. And then later, I'll talk about the CP violating model. So in the CP conserving model, you know that there will be three neutral scalars, two CP even and one CP odd. And so there's an angle alpha that appears when you diagonalize the CP even mass matrix. The angle alpha, just like beta, is a basis independent number. But I can define an n hat, a vector in this two-dimensional flavor space, which has a cosine alpha and sine alpha in the generic basis, and then compute these two objects here, which would be basis-independent quantities, and lo and behold, you get cosine beta minus alpha and sine beta minus alpha. So these quantities are, beta minus alpha is a basis-independent quantity, even though beta and alpha separately aren't. And you can work out formulae for the Higgs masses. Here's an example where you see explicitly that the Higgs masses depend only on basis-independent quantities, namely MA and these Zs, as an example. And here's also an explicit formula for cosine well, 2 beta minus alpha that depends only on invariance. Now, I'm going to skip the discussion of the decoupling limit, which is an interesting story by itself, but in this talk, I want to focus on some other things. So let's now write down all the interactions of this model. And the assertion is that you can always express any physical quantity in terms of basis-independent objects, namely the invariants. So first of all, you know that the Higgs couplings to gauge bosons all either depend on cosine beta minus alpha and sine beta minus alpha. Those are invariant quantities, as I showed you. Here are the Higgs self-couplings, and notice that when I write it in terms of invariant quantities, these capital Zs, the only other object that appears is beta minus alpha, which is an invariant. So indeed, I've related a physical quantity to completely basis-independent objects. Tan beta by itself doesn't appear. But now we come to the fermion. So what do I do? Here there's some model choices. And so what I'm going to do for the moment is make no assumption. I'm going to write every term that can appear. So that's Higgs 1, Higgs 2, couples both to up-type quarks and down-type quarks. Now you know that if you do this with arbitrary coefficients, you will get some flavor-changing neutral currents, but let's do that anyway. I emphasize again, in the minimal supersymmetric standard model, these couplings to the wrong quark do appear at one loop and will generate physical effects. Now, I start off by writing this in the interaction basis. That's what these zeros mean here. And I want to go to the fermion mass basis. And I do that in the standard way with the biunitary transformation of the quark mass matrices, and this CKM matrix comes into play. And so when I do that, I can define, instead of these eta ones and eta twos, which are the Yukawa coupling matrices in the interaction basis, I can define corresponding etas without the zero, referring to the quark mass basis. Now, these objects, eta sub I, these are matrices, these are 3x3 Yukawa coupling matrices, and I labels the Higgs flavor, 1 or 2. So it is also a vector in the Higgs flavor space, and I can dot it into the VEV, either V or W, to get an invariant. And so I've done that here. And one invariant I'll call kappa, and one invariant I'll call rho. And then if you go through the analysis, you will see that kappa is related directly to the quark mass matrices, like so. Rho is completely arbitrary. It's not fixed by the quark mass matrices. And so stick it in, and here is the full three-flavor interaction. This term in red, in the limit that sine beta minus alpha goes to 1 or cos beta minus alpha goes to 0, reproduces the standard model result. That's the decoupling limit when cosine beta minus alpha goes to 0. And so in that limit, I just have the standard couplings, flavor conserving couplings, in fact, of the light Higgs to the up and down quarks. Of course, if I'm not exactly in the decoupling limit, in addition to this term, I'll have this term here. Rho is a completely arbitrary 3x3 mass matrix, and this, therefore, is flavor changing interactions. Now, the three-dimensional case is complicated. Let me simplify to the one-flavor case to point out something else. In the one-flavor case, this is what you get. So there's also a row there, but it's now a 1x1 matrix rather than a 3x3 matrix. Nevertheless, you see that the CP even Higgs couples to QQ bar not only with a scalar component, but a pseudo-scalar component. So not only does this rho generate flavor-changing neutral currents, but if it's complex, PQ here being the imaginary part of rho, you can generate CP violation through the Kao couplings. Okay, now, the MSSM Higgs sector, at least at tree level, is special, and it's one where one Higgs couples to one Higgs couples to the other. It's called type 2, and usually one says that eta 1 u is equal to eta 2 d is equal to 0, but that's a basis dependent statement, so let's convert that into a basis independent statement, and there's the condition very nicely written. It's just the dot product of those two things is equal to 0. Now, the minute you do this, you have actually selected a basis based on a physical assumption, namely the special type 2 couplings. And having done this, tan beta is now promoted to a physical parameter. And in fact, you can check that tan beta is the ratio of these two couplings. Here I'm just working at one generation just to make life easy. And these two definitions are consistent because of the type 2 condition. So tan beta is now a physical parameter. It's basically telling you what basis is one, does this coupling vanish and that coupling vanish. That chooses a special basis.
How would this definition of tan beta look like with the three generations? It would still be direct proportionality of the matrices, or?
Well, there is, I think I looked at that. There is an equivalent definition, but let me not try to reconstruct that in my head now. We can talk about that after the talk. And now I can solve for rho. Again, I'm doing this in one generation, because rho is related to kappa by tan beta, and kappa was related to the mass matrix, and therefore rho is related now to the mass matrix, and you stick that in, and you get the famous, well-known type 2 Higgs quark interactions. But now I want you to notice that in the more general 2 Higgs doublet model, where you don't say one Higgs couples to one Higgs couples to the other, and again, I emphasize that in the MSSM, at one loop, you can have both Higgs couplings to the same quark.
So just a point, there is an exact discrete symmetry, or not really an exact discrete?
Not in supersymmetry, it's not a discrete symmetry.
It's just supersymmetry.
It's just supersymmetry.
There are some sectors which also similarly come some discrete symmetry, which are violated by other sectors, that's why.
Right, exactly. And in fact, those corrections can be large in certain ranges of supersymmetric parameter space. Nevertheless, you can introduce tan beta-like parameters, these ratios of what I called rho to kappa. Now, in model 2, this guy was equal to this guy. But in a generic model, there's no reason why these should be the same. And there's also one in the lepton sector. Now, things get complicated once you go to three generations, because it's not a simple question of there being three parameters. It's more complicated. You might hope that it's approximately this for the third generation, because the Yukawa couplings are largest. So perhaps to a good approximation, this is a good starting point. But this tells me a number of things. First of all, there's a long song and dance about how you should define tan beta in the MSSM and how you should go measure this parameter, say, at a linear collider with some precision. And there are a number of proposals. There are disadvantages and advantages with each proposal. But at the end of the day, I think one of the reasons why there's so much discussion and so much uncertainty in that is because you're trying to force there to be one parameter, whereas the physics is telling you that there are actually, at least in the quark sector, two parameters. And the nice thing about this definition is it's defined in terms of invariant quantities, so therefore physical quantities. And so if you want to think about how to propose to do precision measurements of a parameter like this, I think that one should really be thinking in terms of these, and then when you do the one-loop corrections, to work in terms of these, rather than forcing yourself into a specialized model, particularly because if you've discovered Higgs bosons, you're trying to prove that it is of a particular model. A priori, it could be an arbitrary two Higgs doublet model. So you want to use experiment to try to help you decide what the underlying physics is.
Almost very specific, because you see that if you have models in this case symmetries, then you don't have this problem. If you have some,
that's right,
model with supersymmetry, then you have this problem.
Right, but the thing is, coming in, you don't know, and if you want to use experiment to try to help you help point the way to which model you're in, I think you have to take a slightly broader view in designing the analysis. So I'm not sure how to do what the best procedure to do this is, but at least this is one of the things I want to think about how to turn this into an actual proposal for how you would do precision Higgs studies at, say, the linear collider. Okay, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about explicit CP violation. So let's come back to the most general model where there are complex things. And this is where we found some real surprises. So let me start off with a theorem that states that the Higgs potential is CP conserving if and only if there exists a basis in which all Higgs potential parameters are real. So suppose I give you an arbitrary Higgs potential with some complex things. Can you figure out whether there's explicit CP violation or not? There are potentially four complex parameters. And if you look in the literature, the statements that have been made are something like this, that what you do is you look for relative phases between the various potentially complex parameters, and if they all vanish, you know you have a CP conserving model. And the surprise that we discovered was that this was sufficient, but it wasn't necessary. In other words, we actually found a case, for instance, where you went to a basis where everything was real except for one parameter. Now you might say you have one complex parameter left, therefore it's CP violating. But in fact, if the rest of the parameters of the model had a certain relation, we discovered that you can actually get rid of that phase without putting phases back into the other complex things. And this was a real surprise because it doesn't follow this pattern at all. So let me show you the theorem we ended up asserting, and here it is. What we wanted to do is we wanted to construct a basis-independent characterization of CP violation, and it was remarkably complicated. So you have your tensors, your coupling tensor Z with four indices, and your mass parameter tensor Y with two indices. And so we started putting them together and soaking up all the indices and looking for potentially complex combinations. And it soon became clear that you had to put together quite a few of them before you got something that could be complex at all. And then we wanted to know how many did you have to consider before you would know the answer, and it turned out that you needed to know these four. And two of them, you had to put six objects, in this case, six couplings, Z here, three couplings, Z, three Y. This Z1 here is taking that four index tensor of couplings and summing over two of them, so that produced an object that had two free indices. So that was the assertion of the theorem we asserted. And if you take those complicated expressions, stick in the y's and z's, and see what it looks like in an arbitrary basis, here's what three of the four look like in an arbitrary basis. I'm not going to even show you the fourth, because that would take about three or four pages to write. I mean, incredibly complicated combinations of these couplings. A couple of remarks about these results. First of all invariants of cubic order or less were manifestly real. We found that the imaginary part of any potentially complex quartic or quintic invariant was a real linear combination of those two of the four that I wrote. The imaginary part of any potentially complex sixth order invariant constructed solely out of Higgs self-couplings is proportional to I6Z. Let me stop here for the moment to remark that there were 490 million possible sixth order invariants involving just Z. Now, most of them were real, but there were a hell of a lot of them that were complex. We estimated that to check all of them explicitly using Mathematica would have taken about 5 months of running. We managed to check about 9 million of them, and we found that they were all, if they were complex, they were all proportional to I6Z with either a factor of 1, plus or minus 1, or plus or minus 2. So we have not proved this theorem we're stating, but we have, let's put it this way, strong numerical evidence that this theorem is true. But it's remarkably complex. Let me finish up these comments here. The imaginary part of any potentially complex six-order invariant that is both cubic in Y and cubic in Z brought in a new object, which I call I3Y3Z, whereas all the other sixth-order invariants were just proportional to those first two. And then once you got beyond six, it didn't seem that we needed any more. Again, there are so many of them, you can't check them all. But we did spot checks, we're running Mathematica, checking hundreds of thousands of combinations, and I think we're fairly convinced, though we don't quite have a full proof. We've gotten close, but we don't have a full proof. Now, let me give you some insight into this. First thing, which is quite interesting, is if you look at that matrix Z1, which was summing over two of the four indices, you get the following matrix. It's Hermitian, and it tells you that you can always diagonalize it. So there's a particular basis that's very useful to work in, namely the basis where this is diagonal, which means that lambda 7 is equal to minus lambda 6. And because you can always diagonalize a Hermitian matrix, you can always get into this basis. So let me at least write out the invariants in this basis. And here are three, and I'll show you the fourth in a minute. So at least in this case, it's rather simple, and you can look at it and appreciate it. And now the question is, do you need them all? Or is this an over-closed set, or over-complete set of invariants? And so, for instance, you can check that if you set y equals 0, three of the four invariants vanish, but one, namely I6Z, need not vanish. And then you can go through some other cases and show that basically I could construct situations where only one of the four is complex and the other three are real. So it looks like we need them all. Now what about I3Y3Z? In a basis where lambda 6 equals minus lambda 7, that one is remarkably complex even in this nice basis choice. But let me show you one other thing. You'll notice that these three vanish if lambda 1 is equal to lambda 2 in this basis. And for a while, we thought that all the invariants vanished when lambda 1 was equal to lambda 2 in this basis. But it turned out that this, which is the last one we discovered, actually does not vanish in that limit. So let me look at lambda 1 equals lambda 2 and lambda 6 equals minus lambda 7, where three of the invariants vanish, and then we have that one left which could be non-zero. The first thing we discovered was this is a very interesting choice, because if this is true in one basis, you can show very simply that it's true in all bases. Moreover, the invariant that just depended on the Higgs couplings, which we called I6Z because it just depended on all the Zs, that's zero when lambda 1 is equal to lambda 2 and lambda 6 equals minus lambda 7. So what that means is that if you are if you're in this case, it doesn't matter which basis you're in, because once it's true in one, it's true in all. In that case, you can always rotate the complex phases out of lambda 5, lambda 6, and lambda 7. If that were not true, then there would be an invariant that just depended on the couplings that would be non-zero. Well, which would have a non-zero imaginary part. But we're asserting that none such exists, and therefore it must always be possible to make lambda 5, lambda 6, lambda 7 real. That leaves only one possible parameter, namely y12, which is minus m12 squared, which can be complex. And so in that case, here is the fourth invariant written explicitly. And of course, if the imaginary part of y12 is also zero, then this thing is zero, and now I have CP conservation. But here was a case that we could have everything real except for y12. And yet, if this factor in front of it, which is just a linear combination of the couplings, happened to be zero, then this invariant would also vanish. And so here's an example of a case where I have only y12 complex, and yet I can find a basis to get rid of that phase in y12 without putting the phase back in the other potentially complex parameters. So that was something that surprised us enormously.
Howie, is it not easier? I mean, you have here complex doublets.
Yes.
If you would just write the fields in a real representation by some or four vectors, whatever, that you have all the imaginary parts written in the couple constant, isn't it? This analysis is not much.
Early on in the project, we looked at that. We didn't find that made our life any easier. I must admit, I didn't look at that with CP in mind. I looked at that process with other things in mind. I did not find that particularly easier. Okay, now if you've decided that the model has a CP conserving potential, that doesn't mean that the model itself is CP conserving, because now you have to look at the minimum and see if in the basis where all the potential parameters are real, is the VEV complex or not. If it's complex, then you have spontaneous breaking of CP. About 20 years ago, a number of authors actually addressed this question and wrote down some invariant quantities that we've rewritten in our notation, and they asserted that these things had to be real in order for there to be no spontaneous CP violation. But in order to get to this point, you first have to address the question of whether the Higgs potential itself exhibits explicit CP violation or not. This was a question that the previous authors just had nothing to say. So what's the unfinished business here? I showed you all the Higgs couplings in terms of the invariants in the CP conserving model, but we really want to go back to the more general CP violating model and do that. And so, plus explore the approach to the decoupling limit, which is an aspect of this which I haven't talked about at all, but is, I think, an interesting avenue to explore. I think it's really important to think seriously about how you do one-loop radiative corrections in this way of thinking, particularly to identify the so-called physical tan beta-like parameters. And then address the question of how you're going to actually measure these things in precision Higgs studies at a linear collider. And finally, we would really like to understand what the physical significance of those four explicit CP violating invariants. So here's an example. I've shown you that there's one invariant which we call I6Z, which depends on a sixth order polynomial of the Higgs couplings. That seems to suggest that in order to access this, say experimentally, you would need to have a physical process in which a diagram was involved which depended in some way sixth order on the Higgs couplings. Now, it's not quite that bad because the masses themselves have implicit dependence on the couplings and they come in as well. So it's not really sixth order at the end of the day, but nevertheless, it's telling you that some of these invariants might be much harder to measure than others. And at least I would like to know maybe those two fourth order invariants that we found, maybe those are the things to go after, say, at a precision Higgs factory, say, at a linear collider. And which processes are the best for doing that, we don't know yet, but this is something we'd like to think about. So, that's it. Well, for the discussion here, yes, I focused on the CP violation and the Higgs potential. I mean, obviously, you can.
You think you're only interested in the model that you only respond on CP violation in the Higgs set. Then I understand. But if you take a very general setup, then you have a lot of phases also.
That's true. But let's think about. I mean, it's absolutely true that you'd want to also have access to the any CP violation that enters through the Higgs fermion sector. And an interesting question is, how do you distinguish, how do you separate it out? Again, thinking back to the supersymmetry example, all these things here, these four invariants that depend on lambda 1 through lambda 7, in supersymmetry, you radiatively generate lambda 5, lambda 6, and lambda 7. And if there's CP violating soft supersymmetry breaking parameters, they end up in those lambda 5, 6s, and 7s. And so if supersymmetry, Lorentzian supersymmetry is right, by accessing these particular invariants, you get another handle on how CP violation works in soft supersymmetry breaking. So I think that's a good thing, and we'd like to know about that.
You have two compact scalar fields, and these fields under a CP transformation have some well-defined transformation up to an arbitrary phase.
Mm-hmm.
So to show that you have CP violation, you have to show that for no choice of these two phases, the potential is invariant. Isn't that a lot simpler?
If I gave you that peculiar case, I would challenge you. If I told you, this of course is not very realistic, but if I told you that this particular combination was equal to zero, and Y12 or M12 squared was complex, would you be able to look at that and tell me that that's a CP conserving model?
No, but you can fix the basis.
If you can find the basis in which everything is real, fantastic.
No, fix the basis first.
Yes?
And then define the CP transformation on the fields. You have two arbitrary phases. And then you write down a set of equations that summarize the invariance. Cannot solve these equations for any choice of those two phases.
Well, I think in the end it would be doing the same thing that you're effectively doing here. Well, no, there aren't many equations. Look. In fact, how do we check that this assertion is true? That if this particular combination was zero and Y12 were complex.
Well,
How do we do that? Well, what we do is we write out what the imaginary part of lambda 5 and lambda 6 in M12 squared is in an arbitrary basis transformed from this basis. And it's three equations, and you can solve them numerically. And that's what we do to check this. The problem is that those you can't do it analytically. You have to do it numerically. So, yes, I mean, you're absolutely right in the sense that I can always, you give me a Higgs potential with arbitrary complex coefficients, okay? Then, what would I do? First, I would go to lambda 6 equal minus lambda 7 basis, which I can always do. Once I'm there, there are basically three equations to solve. And if they have a consistent solution, imaginary part of M12 squared equals imaginary part of lambda 5 equals imaginary part of lambda 6 equals 0. Three equations, that's all.
You should find this special case which you found in this way also.
Well, if you can derive this condition from without knowing it, I would be amazed. I would truly be amazed. But as I said, there are three equations that you have to see, does it have a consistent solution or not? Okay? But then you have to start worrying about the numerical stability of solving three nonlinear equations together. What we've done is we have given you a very straightforward algorithm. We have four invariants, and it's just plug-in. They're either complex or they're not. That's the end of the story. But whether to answer a specific question you need to use an invariant or there are other means of doing it, well, it depends. Invariants are not always the easiest way to go, but I think they teach you things. For example, the Jarls-Cog invariant taught you that in order to get CP violation in the standard model, you had to find a diagram that accessed all three generations. And, you know, I suppose we could have figured that out without a fancy invariant, but it gave you, some extra theoretical information and helped understand why the form was coming out like it is. And I would like to understand better what the physical significance of these four particular invariants are, but I think they will teach us something.
Okay, well, let's thank Kelly again. Let's take a five.